voice, when she couldn't anticipate his words before her own.
"I think," said Bay softly, "that you are the truest person I have ever met."
Georgie closed her eyes against the sting of tears. "You're feeling sorry for me, that's all. In the morning, tomorrow, you'll think better of it all. I won't be your ruin, Bay. I won't."
"You're not my ruin. You're my
millstone," Georgie provided, with gallows humor. "Your doom?"
"The doom of the Vandivals?"
The corners of Bay's eyes crinkled. It was an expression that was so uniquely his, humor and patience and a certain wry resignation that sat oddly with his golden charm.
"Never that, Georgie. You're not my millstone or my doom. But I would be proud to call you my wife, if you'd have me."
If she would have him? He had it the wrong way around. Georgie placed her palms flat on the upholstered arms of the chair, using her arms to lever herself to her feet. "It's a beautiful dream, Bay," she said, and every word hurt. It hurt to kill a dream, like tearing the petals off a rose in full bloom. But what if the plant was diseased? What then? "But even if all else weren't as it is, it wouldn't work, Bay."
Bay's face closed in on itself. "I had thought, forgive me if I presumed too much, I had thought that you had come to care for me a little."
The hurt behind his words made her shrivel up inside. This was the moment, she knew, when she should draw herself up and tell him coolly that he was quite mistaken, and that while she valued his friendship, she would never care for him in that way. She had told him so many lies already, by omission if nothing else. What was one more? But she couldn't.
"I care for you too much to let you throw yourself away on me."
There were so many things she could say, flippant and foolish, but she owed him this, owed him honesty, even if it tore her to pieces. Georgie forced herself to look at Bay, to meet his eyes and tell him the truth, even if it was only a partial truth.
"A broken vessel, that's what they call me. There are homes for women like me. Fallen women. Giles..."
How strange to go missish after all this time, to find the words sticking on her tongue as though she were the young lady she once had been.
"Deserves to be shot."
Bay's lips turned white around the edges.
"Georgie, that's his crime, not yours. If he forced you..."
"Stop, please."
She couldn't bear it, not this. Forced her? She'd fancied herself in love with Giles. Until that horrible moment when he'd yanked her arms from around his neck, pushing her back against the wall, muttering words of poison into her ears as his body punished hers. She could remember the mingled pain and disbelief as her dream had turned nightmare.
"It doesn't matter, Bay. Even if I weren't, I don't know if I could be a true wife to you."
There. It was out. The words she wasn't sure she could voice. She could see the confusion in Bay's face.
"I don't understand."
When I think of anyone touching me..."
Georgie's throat closed on the words.
"My poor Georgie."
Bay crossed the space between them in one long step. He reached for her, and then thought better of it. Georgie's voice seemed to come from far away, crackly and brittle.
"So you see, it's quite impossible."
Bay held out a hand to her, very slowly and very carefully. Georgie rested her hand in his, let him draw her to her feet.
"Do you fear my touch?"
The words came with difficulty.
"Sometimes. There are times..."
Times when she couldn't distinguish between what was real and what wasn't. Times when the past pressed in on her. Seeing the expression of pain on Bay's face, she said quickly,
"But not because of you. I know that you would never hurt me."
Not physically, at any rate. It was her heart that was aching. The heart she had told herself that she had hardened beyond all feeling years ago.
"May I?" Carefully, so carefully, Bay cupped her cheek in one hand. Knowing that she was flirting with danger, Georgie let her eyes drift closed, let herself lean into the warmth and tenderness of that hand, pain and pleasure mixed in one. Her senses were heightened, aware of every breath, every motion, of the soft susurration of cloth as he moved, the changes in the light behind her closed lids as his face came closer to hers, the whisper of his breath against her cheek, her lips. "Bay," she reminded herself. "Bay." His lips brushed hers with infinite gentleness, a fleeting touch, there and then gone. Slowly Georgie opened her eyes, her breathing shallow, her muscles aching as though she had just traveled a long way. In a courtly gesture, Bay lifted her hand to his lips. "You do know I would never force you."
"I know."
In her head and in her heart, but she couldn't vouch for the rest of her. He didn't make any move to kiss her again. Georgie wasn't sure whether to be relieved or disappointed. Instead, his fingers toyed with hers, as lightly as his kiss. "It will be an experiment, for both of us. You see, I've never lain with a woman." The backs of Georgie's knees bumped into the frame of the chair as she started back in surprise. She tipped her head back to see him.
"Truly?"
"We'll find our way together." Bay twined his fingers through hers, and the feeling of his bare hands against hers was somehow more intimate, more binding than any hurried coupling.
"You will make an honest man of me, won't you?"
He was turning the tables on her, Georgie realized, putting himself into her power. It was, she thought, so very like Bay. She might be nothing more than a chorus girl, but with a few words he could make her feel like a queen.
"You should marry a Livingston or a Van Whatnot," she said, her voice scratchy.
Bay's brows quirked.
"What's in a name? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet."
"That's an ill-fated example."
"True enough. But trust me when I say that I am old enough to know my own mind."
Softly, he quoted, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments." Georgie bowed her head over their joined hands. In a muffled voice, she said,
"I felt that way for weeks, but I knew there was nothing in it, that there couldn't be anything in it."
"You're my fixed mark, my compass, my lodestar."
Freeing one hand, Bay put a finger under her chin, tipping her face up to his.
"We don't need to go back to New York straight away. We'll go to Paris and Venice. We'll travel the outer corners of the earth. Marry me, under whatever name you choose, so long as you live with me and be my love."
She wasn't the lodestar. Those were his eyes, drawing her forward when she ought to retreat, like sailors following the song of the siren, even unto the ends of the seas.
"More borrowed words," she said.
"If I had words fine enough of my own to give you," he said, "I would. Will you take these? I love you. It sounds so plain, doesn't it? But it's as simple and true as that. I love you, and I don't want to lose you now that I've found you. And I will try, as best I can, to be a proper husband to you."
She was caught, like a fly in a web. She couldn't accept him, but she couldn't bring herself to refuse him. Cravenly, Georgie said,
"I'm sorry, Bay. I've been hiding for so long."
He put an arm around her shoulders, nestling her into the curve of his body, where her head fit comfortably just beneath his chin.
"It's a bit like being an expatriate, isn't it?"
he said, his voice muffled by her hair.
"You don't know which language to dream in anymore, which part of you is real."
"Yes."
Georgie buried her cheek in his waistcoat, feeling her resolve ebbing away. How could she give him up when she knew him better than she knew herself? She loved his perception, his thoughtfulness, his way of looking at the world first this way and then that, always weighing before he spoke, always seeing all sides of a debate. She loved him for it. She loved him. It was a terrifying thing to love someone. Better to tell herself that it was a business proposition or self-preservation, that she was marrying him to escape from Giles or secure her future. Self-interest, cold and simple. But it wasn't, was it? Georgie made one last attempt to set him free.
I don't know if I could be Annabelle. That life is gone.
You don't have to be anything you don't want. She felt his chin move against her hair as he tilted his head down. Thoughtfully, he added, I've always thought that Orsino must have gone on calling Viola Cesario, even after she abandoned her breeches. Georgie felt herself torn between tears and laughter. Only Bay would say such a thing. Georgie turned in his arms, lifting up a hand to cup his cheek, his skin warm and rumpled beneath her fingers. Her America, her new-found land.
I love you, she said brokenly. I love you so much.
Bay smoothed a lock of hair back from her face. George, he said tenderly. My George.
Chapter 8. New York, 1899. George, Georgiana, Giles. George, Georgiana, Giles. The northbound train shook and grunted as it pulled away from the city, past tenements and factories, farmland and dairies. In its rhythmic panting, Janie could hear the three names cycling endlessly one after the other. George, Georgiana, Giles. Nonsense sounds, like something out of a children's rhyme, repetition leeching them of all meaning, all significance. Janie turned to frown through the window, but it was grimed with frost and coal smoke, giving the retreating buildings the air of a French painting, the sort that was all blur and daubs until one looked at it just the right way. The book Janie had chosen for the journey lay unopened in her lap, the pages uncut. It was a tale of adventure, a sequel to The Prisoner of Zenda, which she had devoured with guilty delight in the arid privacy of her own room. She had been looking forward to the publication of Rupert of Hentzau for some time, but her mind refused to take ship, remaining instead in the buzzing hive of the world-building, where Mr. Burke might at this very moment be dictating staccato messages to the telegraph operator. A man's hand, descending on the back of her seat, broke her from her reverie. Hastily, Janie scooped up her book and began to cut the pages. There was a certain type of man, she knew, who made a practice of taking the seat next to an unaccompanied lady. The best defense was feigned absorption. She began vigorously to cut the pages of her book, imagining Rupert von Hentzau unleashed on the inhabitants of the Poughkeepsie train. The hand departed, but was succeeded by a brisk conversation behind her and a flurry of activity, which resulted, 2 minutes later, in a small table being plunked down in front of her. Janie frowned up at the porter.
I'm afraid I didn't... Mr. Burke?
There was no mistaking those eyebrows, or the rest of him, for that matter.
Yes, set it here.
Mr. Burke waved the porter forward. A chipped teapot, well-used cups, and a bowl of grimy sugar cubes plunked down on the table with more force than grace, as Mr. Burke slid himself into the seat opposite.
I've brought tea.
I see.
Janie closed her book over her finger. Ruritania would have to wait. The porter placed a small milk jug on the table and a plate of dry biscuits.
The cups that cheer but do not inebriate, said Mr. Burke solemnly, putting a few coins in the porter's hand. You seemed in need of cheering.
But not inebriation?
Janie waited until the porter had rolled the tea tray down to the next car before asking,
How did you get here?
I walked to Grand Central and then purchased a ticket?
At Janie's look, he relented, saying,
When I read your note, it didn't seem right to let you wander about on your own with a mad Englishman on the prowl.
Janie set her book down on the seat beside her.
And you wanted an invitation to Illyria?
Every man wants an invitation to Illyria.
Mr. Burke's voice was gently mocking. Janie narrowed her eyes at him.
I meant the house.
That, too. Shall I pour?
Janie clutched the side of her seat as the train swayed.
If you think you can without emptying the pot over both of us.
So little faith.
Mr. Burke dealt expertly with the disposition of tea.
Milk or lemon?
Milk, please.
Janie hadn't thought serving tea was among a journalist's qualifications. She had imagined them quaffing beer in tin-roofed taverns.
You do that very well.
Mr. Burke expertly tipped just the right amount of milk into her cup.
And aren't I my ma'am's blue-eyed boy?
Your eyes aren't blue, they're green,
Janie retorted, and wished she hadn't, as Mr. Burke raised his black brows over the tea things. In an attempt to salvage her dignity, she said,
Are you Irish, Mr. Burke? I wouldn't have guessed. That is, your voice.
Doesn't sound like I'm fresh off the boat from the old country?
Well, yes.
Bother the man. Whatever she said, she found she was in the wrong.
You sound like anyone.
Anyone you know, you mean? Not every Irishman sounds like a music hall parody of himself. Some of us can even pass on the fringes of civilized society.
I didn't mean it that way.
But she had, a little, hadn't she? Janie found herself nibbling on the tip of one gloved finger and made herself stop. Mr. Burke handed her cup across the table to her, taking care that their gloved fingers shouldn't brush.
I was raised here, in Hell's Kitchen.
He leaned back lazily in his chair, but his eyes were keen and watchful.
It is rather a long way from Illyria.
Hell's Kitchen was no more than a dozen blocks from the brownstone in which Janie had been raised, but it might have been a different continent. She knew of it only what she had glimpsed in the papers, with their lurid headlines about warring gangs, men knifed in taverns, women who disposed of unwanted children for a fee. It was a lawless place, commonly deemed to be the most dangerous in the country, with all of the risks, but none of the charm, of the frontier.
And yet, said Janie, you seem to have gotten away.
Does anyone truly escape from Hades?
He made no attempt to hide his mockery this time. It dripped from his tongue as sweet and deadly as jam made from poisoned berries.
The underworld tends to keep its own.
Only when you look back,
said Janie, thinking of Orpheus and Eurydice. Mr. Burke dropped a lump of sugar neatly into his cup.
And what would you advise, Miss Van Dyvel? Would you paper over the past?
Janie found herself growing annoyed. It was a strangely empowering feeling.
If that were my intention, Mr. Burke, she said tartly, neither of us would be here.
He lifted his teacup in salute.
A hit, a palpable hit. Fair enough.
Is it?
Said Janie, deciding she wasn't quite done being irritated.
You were supposing rather a lot, weren't you, following me today? If I choose not to admit you, you'll have wasted a day.
Can any day be wasted that includes tea with a charming lady? Don't worry. I don't intend to build a willow cabin at your gate. I have an appointment in Carmel.
You're on the wrong train,
Janie pointed out, before the full meaning of his statement bore upon her.
An appointment with whom?
The coroner.
Mr. Burke occupied himself in shooting his cuffs, making sure the seams sat straight.
It's not a long drive from Carmel to Cold Spring. I've been told it's rather scenic.
In the spring, perhaps.
Mr. Burke was, Janie suspected, deliberately avoiding the point, drawing out the suspense.
Has there been any news?
Other than that the coroner appears to be as pickled as the corpses?
As Janie's face paled, Mr. Burke abandoned his levity. He sat up straighter in his seat.
I'm sorry. That was ill done.
Janie breathed in through her nose, forcing herself to think of corpses and pickling.
Ignoring unpleasantness was only what had gotten them into this mess in the first place.
If she had realized that something was wrong...
Sounding like every governess she had ever had, she said in her starchiest voice,
"You don't need to spare my feelings. In fact, I'd rather you didn't. If I'd wanted my feelings spared, I would never have come to you."
"There's an insult in that somewhere,"
said Mr. Burke wryly, and bit into a biscuit.
"Or a compliment,"
countered Janie, making herself look away from his lips.
"I'm doing you the credit of believing you can speak plainly to me. No one else has."
"Plain speaking isn't an art much valued in society."
"That depends on who you ask. Mrs. Fish prides herself on it, although her plain speaking is less about the pursuit of truth and more an exercise of personality."
Janie bit her lip. She hadn't meant to say that, even though she had thought it for some time. To cover her confusion, she said,
"I found that when people say they mean to be blunt, it's generally because they're about to say something unpleasant. Why go to Carmel if there isn't any news?"
"I won't know if I don't go," said Mr. Burke smoothly. "And it was a chance to kill two birds with one stone. This is a more comfortable place to talk than City Hall Park."
"Only just..."
Janie wrapped her gloved hands around her tea, which had already gone from hot to tepid.
"If you received my note, then you know my concerns about Mr. Lacey?"
Mr. Burke raised a black brow. "Concerns? I thought they were orders."
He took the sting out of it by adding,
"You would have made an excellent superintendent of police."
"If I weren't a woman, you mean?"
"If you weren't one of the 400. Your kind isn't exactly known for mucking about in the dirt."
Janie frowned at him.
"That's not fair. What about Mr. Roosevelt?"
Mr. Burke gave a one-sided shrug.
"There are exceptions to every rule."
Janie cast a sideways glance at Mr. Burke, but decided to leave it be.
"What did you learn about Mr. Lacey?"
"Pursuant to your, suggestions, I've made inquiries. It may take a few days to get answers."
"It may be nothing."
Janie felt her shoulders sag as some of the combative spirit that had been sustaining her drained away. Fighting with Mr. Burke had an oddly invigorating effect.
"It probably is nothing, but his appearance seemed too coincidental for comfort."
"It was," said Mr. Burke bluntly. "I spoke to the port officer. Mr. Lacey entered the port of New York on the 10th of January."
3 days after the 12th night ball.
Janie's spirits dropped. It would have been comforting to have been able to claim Mr. Lacey as the villain. She clung to what reassurance she could.
"Then it was a lie, what he said about coming to cry over his cousin's grave. He couldn't have known before he set sail."
Mr. Burke lowered his chin in acknowledgement.
"Unless Mr. Lacey has a particularly good crystal ball. The St. Paul left Southampton on the 31st of December. If, of course, that is the ship he came on, portmasters have been known to be amenable to bribery."
"So what you're saying," said Janie, "is that we don't know anything at all other than that Mr. Lacey is lying about something."
"Most people are lying about something, Miss Van Dybel. The trick is discovering what."
Outside the window, the Hudson was a flat gray beneath a gray sky. Usually, the sight of the river glimpsed from the train never failed to lift Janie's spirits. Today, its very familiarity only made it the stranger.
2 weeks ago, the worst thing any of us could imagine was that Mr. Newland might sue my cousin for divorce.
Janie looked helplessly at Mr. Burke.
I feel as though I've stumbled into the wrong story.
Mr. Burke raised a brow.
Arthur Conan Doyle or Anthony Hope?
Neither.
Both contained a certainty that Janie lacked, that good would triumph, that everything would be tied up tidily in the end.
Have you reported on other murders, Mr. Burke?
Some.
He was silent for a moment, and Janie wondered what it was that he was seeing as he stared out the window.
Most tend to be fairly simple affairs, crimes of passion of one sort or another. Every now and then you happen on something more complex, like the Guldensup case 2 years ago.
Janie vaguely remembered the furor. It wasn't the sort of happening reported in the papers her mother read, but it had been hard to avoid hearing of it. A woman, with the help of a new lover, had dismembered her former lover, hacked him into pieces, and dumped the pieces in parcels about the city.
They found a headless torso in the river, didn't they?
And other pieces elsewhere, said Mr. Burke grimly. Breadcrumbs to give you nightmares. Even there, the only confusion was in the execution of it. The actual motives were simple enough. They always are.
That's very cynical, Mr. Burke.
I prefer to think of it as being realistic. It's only in serial stories that murder is committed for fantastical causes. In real life, it always boils down to love or money, more often the latter than the former.
The train swayed beneath them. The heavy ceramic cups rocked on their saucers. The tea things seemed incongruously domestic, out of place among this talk of murder. Simple, Mr. Burke had called it. And perhaps it was, the age-old passion for gain, never quite quelled by any of society's pious teachings. Love or money, Mr. Burke said, and more often the latter. It would, Janie thought, be reassuring to imagine Mr. Lacey as a murderer. If Mr. Lacey had killed both Bay and Annabel for Annabel's inheritance, then Bay was innocent. Honor was restored. But Mr. Lacey, if the port officer was to be believed, had been somewhere on the Atlantic on Twelfth Night. A hired killer, perhaps? But that was fantastical, something out of a Penny Dreadful, or the serials in papers her mother didn't care to acknowledge. As fantastical as imagining that Annabel might not have been Annabel? Janie shifted uneasily in her seat.
There was something else, something I didn't care to include in my letter.
Yes?
Mr. Burke held up the teapot, cocking his head in invitation. Janie nodded, and Mr. Burke tipped the spout over her cup. She was glad for the distraction. It made it easier to say what she had to say.
When he called, Mr. Lacey took great pains to inform us that his cousin, Annabel's father, had a ward, who was raised as a sister to Annabel.
Janie almost mentioned the bar sinister, but thought better of it. The waters were muddy enough already. She pinched the leather of the gloves that lay in her lap.
He claims that the woman we knew as Annabel was really Georgiana Smith.
If money is at stake, then it would be rather convenient for Mr. Lacey if Annabel Lacey could be proved not to have been alive and well in New York.
Mr. Burke's eyes refocused on Janie.
What do you think? You're the one who actually knew her.
Not well, said Janie honestly. Annabel was Annabel. I can't think of her as anyone but Annabel, but I don't know. I don't know anything right now.
Mr. Burke smiled without humor.
Radical doubt isn't a pleasant exercise, is it? It might be true. Or Mr. Lacey might have invented Georgiana Smith out of whole cloth, or merely borrowed her. Georgiana Smith might be 70 years old with 16 grandchildren. Or she might have been living in your house, wearing your jewels.
The words sent a shiver down Janie's spine. She felt like a child, alone in a dark house, glancing over her shoulder for someone who wasn't there.
Do you think... is it worth making inquiries?
Do you mean, will I track her down for you? I can't promise I'll be able to help you. I've already cost the world a small fortune in telegrams. But I'll do my best.
Mr. Burke leaned back in his seat.
It's hard to prove a negative, you know. If what he says were true, there might be no records of this woman.
What a very odd thing, said Janie, to live and leave no mark.
Unbidden, the image of her father's books came to mind, some sold, some consigned to boxes, but all bearing his distinctive bookplate, with his name on the flyleaf. Someday, someone, somewhere, would open Racine's Berenice or Molière's Malade Imaginaire and know that her father had lived. Mr. Burke's lip curled.
I don't want to disillusion you, Miss Van Dyvel, but that's the fate of most in our great city. Children die every day without a trace. Men and women disappear. Life is cheap and fleeting.
Janie sat up straighter in her seat. That's a horrible thing to say. Most people have families, communities, even if they aren't in the headlines of the evening news. In our girls' club...
Yes?
That one syllable was enough to make Janie feel like a fool, like a spoiled debutante on a jewel-studded soapbox.
We do our best to make a place for people who might not otherwise have one.
Sewing piecework?
It's not just piecework. We have lectures and classes.
Janie felt herself foundering under Mr. Burke's cynical gaze. Her mother looked the same way when she talked about her work.
But it's more than that. It's the friendships. For girls on their own, that matters, to have someone who cares.
Very softly, Mr. Burke said, "There but for the grace of God?" Stiffly, Janie said,
I am not unaware that I was born with more than most, Mr. Burke. But that circumstance was as much out of my control as the color of your eyes.
Oh, it's my eyes again, is it?
Flustered, Janie looked away. She had lost control of the conversation again, somewhere between the girls' club and Mr. Burke's green eyes.
It occurred to me, if our Annabel was Annabel Lacey, then it wasn't just her life between Mr. Lacey and his inheritance.
Mr. Burke's grin disappeared.
Her children.
I keep thinking of the princes in the tower.
There'd been an engraving in one of her books as a child, the two young princes curled up together, vulnerable in sleep as their murderers drew back the bed curtains.
They're only 4 years old.
That's why you bolted to the hinterlands.
Mr. Burke leaned forward on one elbow.
To take up your spear in their defense?
She made an unlikely shield maiden.
You make me sound very foolish.
Not foolish, said Mr. Burke unexpectedly. Gallant.
His praise made her more uncomfortable than his censure.
It's really selfishness on my part, removing myself from the city.
Retreat, her mother had called it. Unfitting for a Van Dyvel.
Do you know that they take sightseers past our house on the omnibus? We can hear them shouting, "See the home of Ballard Van Dyvel!" They can't even get his name right.
That's how legend works, isn't it? Said Mr. Burke matter-of-factly. Be grateful for it. A century from now, there'll only be the gruesome tale of Ballard Devil, the demon lover of Putnam County who killed 8 wives and tossed them into the Hudson.
Janie forced herself to relax her hands.
Was that meant to be reassuring?
In its way.
He looked at her without mockery, his green eyes thoughtful.
Myth is more durable than history, and far more entertaining.
I thought you were in the business of selling truth.
Mr. Burke's lips twisted in a crooked smile.
When my editor allows it, some truths sell better than others.
Mr. Burke got to his feet just as the conductor lurched past, calling out, Cold Spring! Cold Spring! Next stop!
Do you have a trunk?
The porter has it.
Janie watched with interest as Mr. Burke retrieved a battered leather satchel from beneath the seat.
Is that all you have?
What more does a man need?
He lifted a brow in deliberate provocation.
My people came over from the old country with less.
Mine appear to have emigrated from Holland with several sets of Delftware and a butter churn, said Janie dryly,
surprising a laugh out of Mr. Burke.
There's Mr. Garrett with the trap.
Mr. Garrett was sitting on the box of the governess cart that was used to transport guests the few miles from the station to the house. He was so wrapped in mufflers that only the bowl of his pipe could be seen, emerging from the wrappings. Her brother's groundskeeper had always reminded Janie of a character from one of Mr. Washington Irving's stories, with his long-stemmed pipe and taciturn air. At the sight of Janie, the pipe bowl lowered slightly in acknowledgement, which was, she knew, all the greeting she was going to get.
"Would you like a lift to Carmel?"
Janie asked doubtfully. She wasn't quite sure how Mr. Garrett would take to being pressed into service as chauffeur.
"I've made my own arrangements."
Mr. Burke looked closely at her.
"Is there a telephone at Elyria?"
"Yes, in the butler's pantry."
It had been a compromise between Annabelle's desire for privacy and the incursions of the modern world.
"If the lines haven't come down again."
"I'll be stopping for the night in Cold Spring. If anything makes you uncomfortable, you can find me at Hudson House."
"Mr. Lacey is hardly Jack the Ripper."
At least she hoped not. They had never found the Ripper. Janie decided not to pursue that line of thought. With more confidence than she felt, she said,
"I can't believe he would hurt me."
"Can't you?"
Tipping his hat in farewell, Mr. Burke stepped back into the shadow of the depot.
"Annabelle Lacey appears to have had a remarkably ill-fated history with bodies of water. If I were you, Miss Van Dyvel, I would stay away from the river."
Paris, 1894. June. A woman in a white gown, her hair piled on top of her head, knelt by the river's edge, like Narcissus seeking his own reflection. But there was no sign of a reflection in the water, only a few fallen leaves skimming the surface.
"Miroir de l'eau by Emily Clarkson," read Bay over Georgie's shoulder.
He stood back to take a better look at the photograph.
"If it's a mirror, shouldn't there be a reflection?"
They were at the opening of the Photo Club de Paris's first exhibition, held in the Galerie Georges Petit. The exhibition was thronged by the fashionable, who had turned out to inspect each other rather than the compositions. Scattered among the gratin were critics, artists, and aesthetes, the latter identifiable by their brightly colored waistcoats and exceedingly floppy cravats. Broken bits of conversation floated about the room.
"But is it art?"
"My dear, that dress!"
"His wife and both his mistresses, in the Bois de Boulogne!"
Georgie took a step back, feeling the warmth of her husband behind her, cradling and protecting her.
"Perhaps that's the point of it, that there is no reflection. That is what she sees when she sees herself, nothing but leaves drifting on the river."
"Or," said her husband, squeezing her shoulders affectionately, "Mrs. Clarkson tried and failed to capture a reflection. The camera has its limits."
"Thus spake the solicitor,"
Georgie teased. She still found it piquant that her husband, who lived as a gentleman of leisure, had trained as an attorney. It came out in odd ways. For all his whimsy, she was learning, Bay had a surprisingly practical bent when he cared to reveal it. She imagined it had something to do with being an American, this odd juxtaposition of luxury and practicality.
"It's a very limiting reading."
"Or maybe,"
countered Bay, adopting the solemn expression of the expert about to expound and adding a faint lisp for good measure,
"the very failure of the composition to achieve its own aims is a commentary on the power of the paintbrush to depict more than might be visible to the lens."
"Behave,"
Georgie cautioned, but she was grinning as she said it. They had been bored to tears 5 minutes ago by a writer for the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, who had apparently attended purely for the pleasure of disapproving.
"Just because the man didn't pause for breath doesn't mean there wasn't something in what he said,"
said Bay virtuously.
"High praise,"
said Georgie dryly, but she took another look at the picture all the same, at the miroir that wasn't. It would be comforting to dismiss it as a failed attempt, but there was something about the composition that haunted her. Perhaps it was the scattering of leaves on the surface, or the expression on the woman's face as she gazed into the depths, seeing, what, her own reflection? Or a mere nothing, where there ought to be something?
Turning away, Georgie said rapidly, "It's a bit of a sleight of hand, isn't it? One expects truth in a photograph, but it might obscure more than it reveals."
They moved obediently behind her.
"Even the camera lies?"
"Not so much a lie as an omission."
The words tasted sour on Georgie's lips. Was she an omission or a lie? Taking a firmer grip on her program, she said brightly,
"Shall we move on? We're blocking the throng."
"They don't seem to mind terribly," said Bay,
but he followed her all the same, past rural scenes and women dressed as Moorish maidens, past portraits and landscapes.
Georgie knew it was foolish, but she still kept glancing back, checking to make sure her husband was there, that he hadn't disappeared when she turned her back, nothing more than a figment of her imagination, a prince from a fairy tale brought to life only for a season.
She still half expected the rich clothes on her back to disappear, to turn to rags at the sound of a bell, the enchantment gone.
But it wasn't an enchantment, was it?
There was a gold ring on her finger, and a piece of paper with their marriage lines, binding her to Bayard Van Dyvel. Binding Annabel Lacey to Bayard Van Dyvel. The gallery was too small for the press of people, the perfumes too strong, the voices too loud. Faces in sepia tones stared out at them from every surface, caught in perpetuity by the lens of the camera. A girl with long dark hair falling unbound about her face glared at Georgie. In another, a naked woman lolled in front of the camera, face and form deliberately blurred. Nothing but a body, identity lost. The air felt stale to Georgie, the afternoon flat.
"I hate to agree with our friend from the Gazette, but there doesn't seem to be much to see. Shall we get a hamper and have a picnic in the Jardin des Tuileries?"
"Will you let me ride on the donkey?"
Their hotel was on the Rue de Rivoli, across the street from the gardens. They had spent many mornings strolling together, arm in arm, drinking milk warm from the cows who were brought there for that purpose, the froth clinging to their lips.
"You'll have to battle the nannies for it."
"Cruel woman."
Bay shuddered extravagantly.
"Never mind, then. I'll content myself with lemonade and the puppet theater. Si vous le permettez, monsieur?"
Two men were blocking the door. One was the unmistakable figure of the Comte de Montesquieu, improbably garbed all in mauve, with violets in place of a neckcloth. The other was Sir Hugo. Bay halted, his hand on Georgie's arm.
"What a pleasant surprise. I didn't know you were in Paris."
"You didn't ask. One can only assume that you have been, otherwise occupied. Do you intend to introduce me to this charming creature, or must I live in suspense?"
"This is my wife, Annabel. We are on our honeymoon."
Bay's voice was perfectly composed. Only Georgie felt the way his fingers dug into her elbow, clinging to her like a sailor to a spar.
"My dear, may I present Sir Hugo Medmenham? He was kind enough to introduce me to London."
"How do you do?"
Georgie kept her chin down, hoping Sir Hugo would take her reticence for modesty. She deeply regretted her fashionable hat, a narrow confection crowned with false flowers that perched on the coil of hair at the back of her head and did little to shade her face. A good old-fashioned poke bonnet would be far preferable for her current circumstances.
"Far better for meeting you, Mrs. Van Dyvel."
Sir Hugo took her fingers delicately by the tips and raised them to his lips. Georgie saw only dove-gray gloves and the bulbous red of a cabochon ruby set deep in the folds of a black silk cravat. Her heart was beating wildly against her stays, sweat beading beneath her chemise. Had she been herself, she might have snatched her hand away, but Mrs. Van Dyvel, proper and polite, could only wait until Sir Hugo released her hand, saying over her bowed head,
"My felicitations, Bay. How very expeditious of you. Monsieur le Comte, allow me to present my American acquaintance, Mr. Van Dyvel, and his wife.
Loathing coiled in Georgie's stomach. He thought it was all a joke, didn't he? A mock marriage, a mistress being paraded in public. A prank played on society, and never mind the woman whose heart might be broken by it.
Monsieur le Comte, she said softly, in her governess-taught French, every inch the well-bred young lady, even as she engaged in bloodthirsty fantasies involving Sir Hugo and his ebony walking-stick.
Bay bowed to Monsieur de Montesquieu. It is an honor to meet a great poet in person, monsieur. We have both enjoyed your chauve-souris.
That was a lie if ever Georgie had heard one. Bay had brought it to her, an expensive volume bound in grey moiré, fantastically decorated with bats made of jet beads.
The poetry is self-indulgent, he had said, but the illustrations are worth the price.
Under other circumstances, Georgie would have made a face at her husband, would have enjoyed the shared joke. But not now. She could feel herself freezing into the silhouette of the woman she was meant to be, Mrs. Van Dyvel, prim and tongue-tied. Monsieur de Montesquieu slowly drew the glove from one hand. The empty fingers flapped disconcertingly as he waved it about.
"You disappoint me, monsieur. The poetry isn't meant to be enjoyed. It is meant to be experienced, ingested like absinthe."
"I've never developed a taste for absinthe," said Bay, at his most American. His hand was warm on Georgie's back. "I find I prefer port." Sir Hugo did not like being ignored.
"Perhaps you merely need to sample its pleasures."
His eyes narrowed on Georgie's face beneath her absurd chip of a hat.
"Have you been long in Paris, Mrs. Van Dyvel?"
"About a fortnight."
Georgie kept her hands folded at her waist, a caricature of a gently bred young lady.
"It is quite as lovely as I had imagined."
"The season is nearly over. Your husband has hardly been doing his duty to you, keeping you to himself."
Without waiting for her to answer, Sir Hugo turned back to Bay.
"You must allow me to make some introductions. Madame de Polignac, perhaps? One of your countrywomen, Bay. Although she is quick to tell you that she was raised on the continent, she considers herself almost French."
Monsieur de Montesquieu's pointed goatee quivered with indignation.
"Swimming in a lake does not make one a fish, no more than marrying a prince sweetens the stench of the shop." "No, it doesn't, does it?"
Sir Hugo smiled languidly at Georgie.
"It is as absurd as the current fashion for marrying gaiety girls. Once the glamour is gone, what is left? A mésalliance, pure and simple."
Georgie found she was shaking, not with fear, but anger.
"That depends on how one defines a misalliance, Sir Hugo."
"Let there to the marriage of true minds be no impediment," said Bay softly, and Georgie could feel the tension in her shoulders lighten.
"How quaint," said Sir Hugo.
He adjusted one of the mother-of-pearl buttons on his dove-gray gloves.
"They have what is known as a mariage blanc, the Prince and Princess de Polignac. They are both of a, shall we say, Greek tendency. Do I shock you, Mrs. Van Dyvel? Do forgive me. I had forgot your, sheltered background."
Georgie could only force herself to smile, even as she saw Bay's color go sickly. That Sir Hugo had recognized her, was taunting her with her past, she had no doubt.
"You forget yourself, Sir Hugo. You have been in Paris too long."
"I believe I shall design a coat of arms for Madame de Polignac," announced the Count,
loudly enough for that lady to hear.
"A sewing machine beneath crossed spindles."
Sir Hugo turned his cane about in his hand, making the silver tip glitter.
"You have a crest of sorts, don't you, Bay? Acorns, is it? so industrious, gathering one's acorns together for winter.
To Georgie, he said,
If I might borrow your husband for a moment, my dear?
No, Georgie wanted to say, you can't.
But Sir Hugo was already moving away, drawing Bay with him with an imperious flick of his wrist. She found herself left with Monsieur de Montesquieu, who was striking an attitude and quite plainly looking about for a more likely audience.
"And what of you, Monsieur?"
said Georgie quickly, in her correct but stilted French. Bay and Sir Hugo had paused beneath the photo of a man, or was it a woman, belabored by a storm.
"What do you think of the photographic exhibition? I should be honored to have the opinion of an artist of your caliber."
Monsieur de Montesquieu emitted his famous high-pitched laugh. It seemed to go on and on, one hand screening his mouth, his teeth as small and black as pebbles.
"I have no objection to photography as such. I merely deplore their poor taste in failing to include a picture of me."
"It was very gracious of you to attend in the face of such a bêtise, Monsieur le Comte."
In the corner of the room, Sir Hugo was smiling a particularly unpleasant smile. Bay replied, his voice too low for Georgie to make out the sound, much less the words.
"I am the sovereign of transitory things," Montesquieu declaimed.
Georgie recognized the line as one from Les Chauves-Souris. Bay had slipped his hand into his waistcoat pocket. He was writing something on a slip of paper.
"In which case, monsieur," said Georgie, her eyes fixed on her husband, "as your loyal subject, I shall take it as necessary to make myself disappear. Au revoir, monsieur le comte."
She paused long enough to sketch a bow. Only housemaids curtsied. She'd been taught that by her governess long ago. Her governess hadn't told her whether it was comme il faut to leave a count standing by himself in the middle of an art exhibition. But Georgie didn't care. Her husband was an American. Surely that entitled her to some latitude. No one expected correctness of Americans. She slipped around the Princesse de Polignac, coming up behind Bay, just in time to hear him say in a low voice, "Wasn't that enough?" Sir Hugo lifted his eyes to Georgie's over Bay's shoulder. Loudly, deliberately, he said,
"The girls at Le Chabanet don't come cheap. Ah, Mrs. Van Dyvel, has the Comte wearied you so soon?"
"Like a rich pastry, the Comte is best in small bites."
She slipped an arm through Bay's, limpid and clinging. Her smile was like a candied violet, a precious bit of confectionery stiff with sugar.
"May I claim a wife's privilege, Sir Hugo, and retrieve my husband?"
"But of course, my dear, I cede him to you."
The cabochon ruby in Sir Hugo's cravat glimmered sullenly, the deep red of freshly spilled blood.
"For the moment."
Chapter 9. Paris, 1894. June.
"What an appalling man!"
It was all Georgie could trust herself to say.
"Yes, he is."
Bay summoned up a shadow of a smile as he offered Georgie his arm.
"Shall we have that picnic?"
They purchased their hamper, but the savor had gone out of the potted goose liver. They set out their blanket near the large round fountain, too far from shade. The sun burned down on Georgie's inadequate hat, and the colors of the garden seemed flat and hard, the flowers too garish, the water too bright. The squawks of the puppeteer and the delighted cries of the children grated on Georgie's ears.
"What did you think of the Comte de Montesquieu?"
Bay propped himself on one elbow, his pose a pretense of ease.
"He is one of the sights of Paris."
"I was a sight more interested in his companion. What did he say to you, Bay?"
Bay bowed his head, pretending great interest in a confection of chocolate and cream.
"They say the crystal ring on Monsieur de Montesquieu's finger contains a single tear, but he won't tell anyone whose. Some say it's Lamartine's, others the Empress Josephine's."
In that case, said Georgie tartly, who did Sir Hugo stick to get the blood to fill his cravat pin?
It's a ruby, I think, said Bay helpfully, but dropped his eyes to his pastry again at Georgie's hard look.
What did Sir Hugo want, Bay? And don't tell me it was merely to congratulate you on your nuptials.
He recognized you from the Ali Baba.
Bay set the pastry aside, uneaten.
I told him the truth.
Which is?
That you were a gentlewoman.
Bay didn't raise his head. With difficulty, he said.
He understood.
Her husband was a very bad liar. Georgie supposed she ought to be grateful for that. It was one of the qualities she generally admired in him, his earnestness. What was the price of his understanding?
The color rose up to the tips of Bay's ears. 500 francs. I don't mind the money, Georgie.
You might have told me.
I didn't want to worry you.
Bay plucked a blade of grass, bending it between his fingers.
It was bad luck running into Sir Hugo.
You knew that we ran the risk of discovery when you married me.
She sounded sharper than she'd meant to, but she minded.
She minded terribly that their peace had been disturbed. Over the past month there were times she had believed herself entirely what she pretended to be. He won't be satisfied with 500 francs.
No.
Bay hesitated and then said,
he has invited us to join his party at the Grand Prix. I am to pay him the next installment there.
To fund his adventures at Le Chabanet?
It was the most expensive whorehouse in Paris, patronized by the Prince of Wales, among others. Georgie found herself suddenly angry.
You can tell Sir Hugo to find another banker. You won't frank him again.
Bay pressed his eyes shut. What else are we to do, Georgie, if he makes good on his threats?
Then we'll tell the world a thing or two about him.
Her voice was strident. Georgie made herself lower it, leaning her head close to her husband's. To the world they must have been the picture of a courting couple, but her words were anything but lover-like.
Actresses hear things, Bay. There was a girl hurt a few years ago while Sir Hugo and his friends were playing at their Hellfire Club— an actress, and that's only the tip of it.
Kitty, her face hard and old beneath her paints. Dozens of others. It would be a wonder if his lordship didn't have the pox.
Well, don't you imagine Sir Hugo's rich fiancée might want to know some of the details?
Bay sat back on his heels, lines on either side of his mouth. Blackmail for blackmail? It was a good job he'd married her. Her husband was too good to survive on his own.
Call it measure for measure, or self-defense, if you will. You'd hardly hold your fire if someone pointed his pistol at you, would you?
Bay cleared his throat. That would depend on the circumstances, I would think.
This isn't a discussion of the law in Blackstone, Bay.
There were times when it was well to look at all sides of a situation. Others where one needed to act.
If you won't defend yourself, let me deal with Sir Hugo.
They made an instinctive movement of negation. Did I tell you I had a letter from my mother this morning? Georgie didn't know whether to hug him or empty the dregs of their lemonade over his head. He might well have had a letter from his mother, but if it hadn't been his mother, it would have been something else. Her husband, she was learning, shied from confrontation. His chosen weapon was diversion.
"How very timely," said Georgie dryly.
The color rose in her husband's cheeks, but he said doggedly, "It is at that. She wants us to return to New York." After a pause, he added, "My sister's engagement is off."
"I wouldn't have thought that would cause you to repine." You didn't sound very fond of the man.
It's worse. He's proposed to Anne.
Oh, dear.
Georgie was momentarily diverted.
Perhaps she sees something in him?
The chance of escaping my mother, perhaps.
Bay nudged a clump of grass with the polished toe of his shoe.
My mother is, well, let's just say she's not an easy woman. And I imagine she's about as pleasant as a nest of hornets about now.
Georgie leaned back on one arm.